You know, I'm in a constant state of bicycle shopping.
Oh, no.
Always shopping for a bike. Always shopping for a bike. I haven't bought a new bike in 10 years, but I've been shopping for a bike basically my whole life.
Uh-huh. And? You bought one?
You do this on a constant basis. You're going to flitter from one thing to the next. I found one that, I don't know, I keep kind of coming back to. It's called the Straggler.
Oh.
And, okay. You know, a lot of times I don't like names of bikes. I get, like, there's one, Salsa makes one called the Warbird, and, like, that sounds kind of cool, but then I don't want war. I don't want to be riding around a Warbird.
Warbird? That doesn't make any sense.
It's, like, it's just the whole connotation of war. Who wants that? Not me.
War. What is it good for?
But the Straggler is like, I'm slow, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I am the Straggler.
I get it.
It seems like it's speaking to my soul.
I think you should buy it.
Well, do you want to help me with it?
No.
How about you sell your car, and then we can use the proceeds to buy a bicycle? That's how things are these days.
Oh, it can't be that expensive. Is it that expensive?
Actually, it's not. It's expensive as bicycles go, but... So, you can buy a whole bicycle, like most people would, but I would buy the frame set, which is just the frame and the fork. And as far as frame sets go, it's inexpensive, but then you have to build the whole thing, and that basically doubles your price, because if you have to buy all the components separately, everything is really expensive.
Just buy the damn thing pulled together and go ride it.
No, it's got the wrong gearing. It's got a one-by drivetrain. Who the hell wants a one-by drivetrain?
I don't even know what that is, and it's like, hoo-hoo, over my head.
Yeah, who cares? I need a two-by, or a three-by would be awesome, but nobody does that anymore. I'm too old. And the name of the company, I don't know, the name of the company is Surly, and I don't know, I always found that to be a weird
Surly
name.
Surly Straggler? That is you.
Surly Straggler. Well, I don't know what the Surly is supposed to be. Is
it's
it supposed
you.
To be the mindset, is or are they referencing something else with Surly? Because it seems like a weird name for a bike company. Why would you name your bike company like Surly?
Maybe it's someone's last name.
Would you name your bike company Rude?
If it worked.
And the bike would be obnoxious? The rude obnoxious?
Well, the Surly Straggler, I think, it just fits you. I think that even, that cements my...
I don't know why you think I'm surly. That's very disheartening to think that my co-host thinks of me as being surly.
Well, I think it's kind of cute to be surly.
Though I was thinking about it, and because, you know, I was riding yesterday, and I'm on my mountain bike, which I'm using as a road bike, which is really slow. Just to put things in context, I have a real road bike. It is 22 years old. It's a 2000 Le Mans Zurich, which is a really nice bike, but it's, you know, it's 22 years old. So it is genuinely, it's an antique.
It's older than you.
It's not older than me, dum-dum. I'm 51, so it's less than half my age. Okay. I'm dating a supermodel, I guess.
Oh,
anyway, when I ride that, my average speed is 15.5 miles an hour, which is not fast. Most roadies are at least 16 and a half or more. Mm-hmm. When I ride the mountain bike on the road, it's 14 miles an hour. So it's, you know, it's pretty slow. So I'm the Straggler, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the Surly part, yesterday I was riding along, just minding my own business, and I hear a couple of cyclists coming up behind me, and they're about to pass me. And, you know, you're supposed to ding a bell or at least call out on your left or on your right to know that, you know, so to let people know that you're about to pass them. It's just, it's manners. It's polite. Mm-hmm. That's how I was raised.
Mm-hmm.
In all places, New York and Connecticut, up in the horrible northeastern part of the United States where nobody has any time for manners. When I was coming up in the 80s and 90s and riding bikes and, you know, as a kid, they would always say, you know, make sure you know, alert people that you're going to pass them. It's just manners. It's niceness. So they don't do that. They come up beside me, and I turn over to them, and I say, good morning, because it was a nice morning, you know. No one was going really like a crazy racer's pace. Nothing. No reply.
Mm.
So let's just recap that. As they're passing me, I say good morning.
Yes.
And then I wait a couple of beats, just long enough to realize that I'm not getting a response, and then I say, or not. So it's good morning, no response, or not. Loud enough for them to hear me, just to be clear. I guess that's a little surly, maybe. It might be.
It is surly. I think that's funny. How old were they?
One was kind of young. He could have been like 20. The other one's older, maybe 45 or 50.
Okay.
But they were on, you know, pretty decent road bikes. So they passed me at a reasonable pace. But the funniest thing was, I don't know what was going on, because they passed me and they were about 100 meters ahead, or I'm sorry, 100 yards ahead of me, maybe, for a couple of miles. And they should have dropped me. They should have been long gone, but they weren't. And I think they started looking back and noticing that I was still like 100 yards behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that weirded them out, or, and these are two guys. I don't know what the deal is. I caught up to them and I'm past them.
That's so weird.
On my mountain bike. And they're on road bikes. This is like, these two guys are basically in sports cars, and I come up in my truck and
pass and your Prius.
My 28-year-old truck, because my mountain bike is 20 years old.
Oh, wow.
Boy, that was a boring story, huh?
No, that wasn't a boring story. It made me think of something, because the reason I asked how old they are is like when I was still working and, you know, I felt like I was aging rapidly, which I probably was. Like some of the younger folks that would come in, particularly like the techie guys, like would have that same response. Like you'd walk into the workplace and be like, oh, good morning. Usually people would say good morning or whatever. And there was this one guy, I don't know what his problem, he would never respond. And he was like the youngest like guy on the new tech team. And this one time I just looked at him directly one time and said, oh, good morning. How are you? And he literally, to avoid me, walked into a wall.
Oh.
And I don't know what that was about.
Wait. Can I do that too? If I want to avoid you, do I just need to walk into a wall? There are plenty of walls.
But it's just
I got walls.
Just say good morning. I mean, really? It's like that difficult? Anyway.
Catherine, I'm shocked at you. He's probably on the spectrum, you know, the autism spectrum.
I realized that like 10 years later or whatever.
10 years. Well, wow. Delayed response.
Yeah, delayed synaptic response.
Now that I've wasted all your time with bicycle nonsense.
That's okay. What else is there to do?
Talk about public art?
I think public art would be fun.
I kind of like the Met. Do you like the Met?
I do like the Met.
Can we just make sure that we understand we're talking about the Met, not MoMA?
Instead of MoMA?
Miss MoMA. Miss, whenever anybody says anything art related, it always comes out as MoMA in your ears.
No, I didn't know they did a public sculpture annually where they commission work for the facade. I did not know that.
I have a feeling we have very little knowledge of what goes on there. It's a big institution that basically spans the globe. So not knowing about what they're doing is...
I just thought that was very interesting.
So this guy, I came across a video.
Mm-hmm.
The Met was installing some new artwork that they had commissioned by this guy named... Hugh Locke, and my dad is named Hugh, but they spell it differently. I don't know why he's got to be all fancy and spell it H-E-W. It just confuses me. Anyway, I was taken by it. It was the Met, so I gave it a try because the Met stuff has usually been pretty good. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit woke, but in overall, I thought it was a really great couple of pieces that he built. And then I loved the explanation. The video was great.
The video was great.
Yeah, he's talking and he makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, crafted these things very thoughtfully. And so he's got four works that are on the outside of the Met right now.
Mm-hmm.
Two are vases, basically large overscaled vases that are gilded. And it's a collage basically of things from the museum, but very intentionally collaged together.
Yeah, they're four sculptures that are in the shapes of either whole or fragmented trophies, as he was referencing them as trophies. I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, he makes a lot of these interesting points about what he thinks about museums. And one of them was that the museum collection is a representation of the museum's power. And that was kind of an interesting thought because it's kind of true, I guess. I mean, it's based on how much, it's like firepower. If you have a lot of bullets, you have a lot of power. If you have a lot of artwork and you know, impressive, rare artwork, you're kind of a heavyweight. People want to come and see you. You have more room to negotiate on stuff.
Right. And let's backtrack a little bit. Like the title of the piece is called Gilt, G-I-L-T. And then he referenced it as like a kind of a, not a juxtaposition, but like G-U-I-L-T, Gilt.
A play on words.
Play on words.
Almost like a pun.
Right. Why the Gilt though? G-U-I-L-T, Gilt.
I don't know how much of this played into the work, but he kind of skips over it here and there about talking about who owns these, where do these things come from. And he doesn't go so deep into it that it starts to bother me, but it's kind of silly. But it is something that he was playing with. And the fact that it's all surface, because it's just a fiberglass sculpture in the end.
Right.
Representation of what's inside the gallery. But there was a lot of thought that went into it.
There was a lot of thought. Yeah, the
and
trophy.
I thought it was visually expressed.
It was visually expressed. I thought it was interesting because the trophies, he said, were actually the Metropolitan Museum, and he considered that the prize. And then the objects with the power, like you said. And then,
The two vases I liked, but the masks were kind of almost artwork that wasn't there because it's almost like invisible art because they're splintered and you only get like the bottom part of the jaw and you're supposed to imagine the rest, but those were a little less successful. Anyway,
I thought those were less. Yeah, those were the broken mask. One is pre-Columbian and one is from Africa.
I couldn't tell that based because there was so little there to see.
Right.
But the upside to this is, wow, we found a great artist talk and then some great work, which is nice. And it's at the Met, which I guess doesn't come as much of a surprise because the Met's awesome.
The Met is
awesome. I mean, it's like 10 times better than the MoMA for sure.
I did like how he spoke about it. I found a different piece. I was kind of looking into this a little bit more because I was just really intrigued that they do this annually and commission these pieces for the facade. And as interestingly as Hugh Locke spoke about his own work, I found a quote. Sheena Wagstaff, Leonard A. Lauder, Chair of Modern and Contemporary Art of the Met. And she described his work as such. It's just different than how he talks about his own work. No. And she says, Hugh Locke uses a delirious aesthetic of abundance and excess to reflect themes of deep urgency in the past and present, including wealth, imperial power, and prestige, astutely critiquing their visual iconography through reclamation. Locke's work deftly interweaves the fine lines between theatricality, visual beauty, and critical insight. And I really liked his description a lot more.
I think that once I'm emperor of the world, one of the first things that's going to go are people who, not the people, but it's going to be outlawed. You're not allowed to study art history. Maybe art history, but curatorial studies, whatever right. degrees these people have. Come on.
I know. I'm not making fun of her. It's just more More of that art speak.
It is art speak.
It has nothing
art
to do with Sheena.
Outlawed.
But art speak is outlawed. But I had to say that because, you know, to hear the artist actually describe his work. And with this, it was like a subtle passion, and the whole vibe of his was just, he was like in the moment. He just talked about it.
Well, it was low-key passion.
It was very low-key passion.
He was passionate about it,
yeah.
But he didn't say it excitedly. He said it almost solemnly. Remember my point about artists lying, and then the art reviewers lie about it, and then the curators already starting to make up the lies about what the work represents. When we literally just heard, not in the same video, but you know, when you can actually have the artist's words.
Seeing that, it was just like night and day. He was just so matter of fact about it and in his space about it. And then then they have to come and put this frosting over it to make it even better, you know.
And not trying to use every word they were taught in college.
Every word, yeah. Anyway, so it's a beautiful facade on a facade. I just thought it was beautiful. It just really was good. You know how like a power of a collection. It's like if someone has a ton of like collection of good stuff, good art, they have power. And I would think that Microsoft's one of the founders,
Paul Allen,
who died in 2018, had quite a plethora of work that's on display now all across Christie's worldwide and will be up for auction. Yeah, November 9th and 10th in New York.
He died, and now his collection is finally up on the block. Mm-hmm. Christie's must be, their mouths must be just watering at the idea of selling all this stuff.
$1 billion, they're predicting. $1 billion.
I'm not saying they're grave robbers, but they want to make news of the fact that they're selling off the dead guy stuff now.
What did you think of that?
Which is a little bit gross. Looking through his collection, my takeaway was that, and this, I'm going to give a quote, which I thought was a little bit self-serving.
Mm-hmm.
For Christie's, quote, there was no advisor. This was something that he did himself in buying at the highest levels, decisively and virtually without mistakes, which is something you very seldom see. So regular people can't buy art?
I had that same quote. I had that. That was from Max Carter.
I
had that same quote.
I should have let you read it.
No. I'm glad you brought it up. We're seeing things the same way. And it's just like, I'm an average person and I periodically buy some art, but no way could I buy like a Botticelli or anything. I just don't have the financial bandwidth to do that. I mean, I just don't. But, you know, to me, it's like, was it that this was some magic? Because this guy was like magic. You know, he did it virtually without mistakes. No, he bought what he liked. And it didn't matter that it spanned 500 years. They were talking about, the work spanned like 500 years from the late 15th century through works executed in the 2010s. So what? He bought what he liked. And that's what made it great for him. And if it made it great for other people, good. But he bought what he liked. And that's what art's about for me, right? You buy
but
what you
also,
like.
It also points out that you don't need an advisor to buy good stuff that actually winds up being really valuable. In fact, it's probably like Wall Street guys. Wall Street doesn't have a good record of picking stocks.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally on a yearly basis, they have the chicken pick the stocks randomly by what it scratches on the newspaper that they lay out.
Mm-hmm.
Half the time, the random stocks don't outperform the stocks the stock market whizzes pick.
Right.
Mutual funds outperform the market, or not that they can't outperform the market, but they outperform the picks by the smart people on Wall Street, right? Goldman Sachs was big news several years ago that, oh, you know, their money doesn't come from picking good stocks. Their money just comes from the transactions that you do with them.
Right. Anyway.
Yeah, so I found that a little bit annoying.
It's I found that annoying, too.
And oh, look what a norm did.
Right. Well, I don't know how much of a norm he was. I mean, but...
That's true. I mean, obviously he was a very smart person, and a very smart person doesn't take much to see through the bullshit in the art world.
Right.
And find the stuff that's actually good.
Right. And if you're buying what you like and you have a good eye and you know, for detail and you know, your aesthetic is spot on. I mean, I don't think he needed an advisor. But the thing that kind of touched me is something we've talked about before is like when these pieces are sold, like when the museums were selling off pieces, my fear was they wouldn't be cared for properly. And now there's some fear among the art folk that some of these works will disappear for decades and just be hung on someone's wall. Well, I hope it's hung on someone's wall in some palatial, fantastic, clean place where it's cared for properly. I doubt that they're going to spend several million and like, you know.
Well, that's the problem. This generation, the people who buy it are fine, but their kids will probably ruin it.
Yeah, you don't want them smoking around it and stuff or whatever. But I don't know. Vaping, yeah, whatever. But, you know, so I guess that is...
Or dumping tomato sauce on it.
That was something else. Yeah, so I don't know. How do you feel about just real quick, about the collection being sold off? Do you think it'll be back in museums because these people are like the super wealthy and they like their...
Well, I think it probably will, as they actually admitted this, but they do mention that, yeah, they will probably be loaned out because when a famous work of art is put in a museum and people see it, it raises the awareness of it. Mm-hmm. And that raises its value.
Right. So much for philanthropy, huh? Yeah. But anyway.
Well, you can do both.
Yeah, you can do both. And so the money, happily, will be donated to the philanthropic causes that Alan supported. And he was a conservationist and had several irons in the fire with things like that. So good. That'll be good money used for good causes.
I think the takeaway here is that it's a little bit distasteful to talking about selling a dead guy stuff.
Right.
So blatantly, like making a big deal of this was Paul Allen. You know, obviously they're trying to just raise the prices on this by associating it with the founder of Microsoft. So
they did.
Christie being Christie again, Christie's being Christie's again, and just gross and going for the dollar, regardless of how.
Yeah, Christie's will make their money, but so will some good causes. So that's good.
Well, maybe the surprising thing for me was he had a Hockney in his collection, and it was like,
yes.
I'm usually not a huge fan of Hockney. I just find it to be fairly superficial. But
I thought so.
The one he had in there, I was like, wow, you picked out the one Hockney I really liked.
Well, that's what they were saying, that he had probably some of the masterpieces of these artists that might have been the best Hockney
ever.
Well,
they say that, but that's all self-serving. It's like, oh, well, you know, if you're going to buy Hockney, this is the one to buy.
This is the Hockney to buy. But I would agree.
From us.
From us.
It's like, oh, he has great taste. And now you can buy that from us. So it's just another one of these really unpleasant.
Well, but you agree that, I mean, it was a good
salesmanship
piece.
Nonsense.
It was a good piece.
They're just being salesmen. They're just being, they sound like used car salesmen. If you peel off the veneer and just look at what they're actually saying, you know, do a little bit of translation into normal speak, they're just used car salesmen. Oh, look at this used car. It's only got, you know, 3 dents in it. The engine works almost 50% of the time, which is, you know, better than no.
Right. I know. Well, at least it's not Van Gogh's Sunflower with the damaged frame. Minimally damaged frame.
Are you saying you wouldn't own a Van Gogh?
I would love to own a Van Gogh.
Would you rather have Van Gogh or a can of tomato soup?
Mm.
Now you can have both.
Now you can have both. What the hell? What the hell is going on?
I should have looked it up on our show notes, but we talked about the Mona Lisa having cake thrown at it
a few months ago. Mona Lisa eats cake, right.
Well, they're at it again. The, quote, protesters threw a can of tomato soup at a Van Gogh in London.
Right. It's called the JSO, or the Just Stop Oil people. And there's literally two people that dress in T-shirts that says Just Stop Oil.
Oh, I get it. I thought they meant like petroleum, but they mean Just Stop Oil painting.
No,
they're against
they meant
oil
petroleum.
Paintings. Because why else would you pick a painting?
Oh, there is some thought behind this, not deep thought. These two people in these Just Stop Oil T-shirts.
Please.
Wait,
Catherine, describe to me how there's thought behind this.
I'm getting there.
Okay.
I'm getting faster. There. Anyway, these two people in Just Stop Oil T-shirts bust into room 43 of the National Gallery, and they opened tins and threw what appeared to be tomato sauce onto this Van Gogh. And they were shouting, and then they glued themselves to the frame, which is not the first time they glued themselves to a frame. Oh, to the wall. Okay. A frame comes next. Anyway, they were shouting, "What's worth more, art or life? Is it worth more than food, worth more than justice? Are you more concerned about the protection of painting or the protection of our planet and people?" And so they were referencing the cost of living and millions of cold, hungry families who can't even afford to heat a tin of soup. I don't know why they picked the sunflower. Maybe because it represented...
because it's famous.
The earth, yeah. But I did not know that Van Gogh painted the sunflowers just to decorate his house.
Well, that's what they say. I don't
Paul
believe
Gauguin.
Anybody.
I want to believe that. I want to believe that.
Okay, that's fine. You can. Hey, that's okay. I'll let you believe that.
Okay. But anyway...
See how generous I am?
You're just fantastic. Okay, the same group, several months ago, wearing the same T-shirts, covered a John Constable masterpiece with their take on apocalyptic vision of the future. And then they glued themselves to the frame. Did you know about that?
You know, glue comes from petroleum products.
Right.
Most of it doesn't. Either that or rabbit skin. Literally, rabbit skin. So, what's the point here?
What's the point? I mean, so, and anyway, they glued themselves to the hay wain. It was painted in 1821, and it shows a wagon traveling across fields in the Suffolk countryside, and it's one of the most popular paintings in the National Gallery. And they said that they had their apocalyptic vision of the future, so they wanted to cover up this idyllic painting with their apocalyptic vision of the future to show what will happen to the landscape if people continue using oil.
Wouldn't the apocalyptic future be running out of petroleum and destroying the environment, so we're wind up back on horses and carts?
They didn't go that far. That's why I said there was something. There was something. So, and you know, and then they also attacked a Scottish gallery, and they targeted another 19th century landscape by Horatio McCulloch called My Heart's in the Highlands. And so these people are like looking for this like earthy stuff. They're not like targeting like the Mona Lisa or portraits. They're targeting.
Well, they did.
I don't think, was it the same people? Was it the Just Stop Oil that threw
the cake?
Still
protesters, and it's still the same idea.
Yeah, but
is
this
they're
particular,
basically, they're
yeah.
trying to find important pieces that are going to get a lot of airplay. They're just looking to be famous.
I know, but when they actually glued themselves to the hay wain, and they ruined the frame, and the way they stuck that little piece of paper onto the actual painting, like it touched the painting, it wasn't...
Oh, no.
I know, and it screwed up the varnish.
Yeah, varnish should restored. Be cleaned anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So it was not. But, it was not. Big. But it just
you know what you know
off.
What that does. It causes more money to be diverted to the museum and less money diverted to the poor people who need to heat their tins of soup.
Heat their tins of soup, right? So I guess if you're like hungry, you can get soup and cake
at the museum.
At the museum.
Just put a bowl
there.
Under the most expensive artworks. Just put a
right,
bowl under
wait.
There and catch whatever food these idiots throw at it.
Wait. Just wait. So what's with the destruction of artwork?
They're not destroying artwork. They're just being dumb. If I can talk to these people directly.
Go ahead. You might.
Hey, guys. Just so you know, we can do two things at once. We can work on global climate change, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can build museums, and we can protect artwork, and we can look and enjoy artwork. You know, if you're criminalizing enjoying stuff, I don't think you're going to get far with that, because why bother then?
You're right.
Well, naturally. Also, just two little points about this, you know, not being able to heat up your soup can, your tin of soup.
Right.
Well, if you have the soup, right, in a tin, okay, it's nicer if it's warmed up, but I'd rather have the tin than have the gas to heat it, because I can eat cold soup.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're worried about how expensive energy is these days, maybe you should talk to Putin about that. I don't think the gallery is driving up prices. I think it might be Putin. I think you've kind of completely failed to see the larger picture here, people.
They thought part of it through, but not all of it through.
These are not smart people. If you're done with that, brings us to our least smartest person.
The destruction of art. It's all about destruction today.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Go ahead, your favorite
well,
artist.
Well, I
your
don't
favorite.
Know that we can call this destruction of, quote, art. It's just destruction of small paintings by Damien Hirst.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and the planet as well. He's doing, see these guys should
fire.
Be, why aren't these guys going after Damien Hirst? Because what he did It was like a global catastrophe in miniature.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I should tell our listeners what Damien Hirst did recently.
Yeah.
Damien Hirst made 10,000 paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get excited. They're not really paintings. He basically took sheets of paper, like regular 8.5 by 11 paper or whatever. You know, the English have a slightly different. It's like 8 by 12 or some silly thing. And dribbled on it. And he's got 10,000 of these.
The dot paintings.
The dot paintings, i.e. dribbles at that at that scale. He sold them as NFTs. And he made the paintings and then attached each one to an NFT. And then sold the NFTs. And then after a year, the people who bought the NFTs get to decide, do they keep the NFT, which is the non-fungible token, which is basically just a string of computer bits mm-hmm. that says you own this artwork, or you can keep the physical painting. And if mm-hmm. they chose to keep the physical painting, they have to trade in their NFT, they have to give over their NFT, and then they get the physical painting. If they chose the NFT, then Damien destroys the painting.
Mm-hmm.
And about 50% decided to go with the NFTs and 50% decided to go with the physical mm-hmm. painting.
Yeah,
so he's
really
burned 5,000 paintings.
I thought it was interesting. And it just cut off on like NFTs and the question of ownership. But this curator and art critic, Reichert, he was hosting different discussions about what blockchain technology, et cetera, et cetera. But I thought it was funny that he said, even with his NFT project, Damien Hirst gets stuck in the ownership criteria of analog art.
That's a nonsense thing to say. I don't even know what he's trying to say there.
What is
I don't
he
know
trying
what that
to
means.
Say?
Well, he doesn't know what he's trying to say. It's just, it's word soup.
I couldn't even read the rest of the article. I mean, there's no point in talking about the rest of it and all the ownership. It just goes poof, like it's just done. But is he saying that because he's still attaching ownership to the NFTs, it's an analog mindset? Like, what is he saying?
Catherine, I don't know why you're thinking about it. It was a nothing statement. The guy is probably doesn't understand NFTs. He's just trying to make word soup to make it sound like he knows what he's talking about. Because
mm-hmm.
he conveyed no meaning with that sentence.
Yeah, it haunted me.
He's an
it haunted
idiot.
Me.
God, I'm talking about a lot of stupid idiots today, huh?
I must be a genius. That kind of was an interesting non sequitur. I mean, I don't even know where that came from, but I was like, what is he saying? How is he stuck?
Is he stuck in
ownership?
No. He wanted to have a quotable sentence. It didn't matter if it made sense or not, but ownership and NFTs, and that's the big thing these days.
Right.
So he put them together, because why not? Doesn't make sense.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Is this just a stunt from Hirst?
Everything Damien Hirst does is a stunt. Mm-hmm. Show me one piece of artwork that he's ever actually made.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be interested. I've never seen anything that he did that could be considered art. And he made 10,000 of these things. Oh, wait. Did he make them or did his minions make them?
Oh, probably. Don't the minions always do that kind of shit?
Only when he fires them during COVID and then collects his PPP anyway. Remember that scandal?
No.
Yeah, he got relief from the government. He fired most of the people working for him, which he's got dozens, if not hundreds of people working for him. I don't remember what the number was. But then he also still applied for relief from the government to get to pay those people. And this is during the pandemic that he started this.
Mm-hmm.
So he probably had them paint all the stuff and then fired them and then collected the resources from the government.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
He's good at collecting money.
Yeah, and he's good at doing like stunts, I guess. It's just like he's not the first artist to burn his work.
That's true. He's also not the first one to start this NFT stuff. It starts the article at the beginning of the article. It says, following in the footsteps of another star artist, Jeff Koons.
Oh, no.
Well, that's a winning couple, isn't it? Jeff Koons and Damien Hirst. Oh, we covered Damien Hirst NFTs in episode 43, by the way.
We did.
God.
But I do want to give a nod to DeGrazia, who burned his paintings.
Okay, fine. Jeez, you were in love.
Who burned his paintings in the 70s as a protest on taxation.
I haven't burned any of my paintings. Maybe I should.
He went out in the desert and just burned his paintings as a protest on taxation. He said he was a millionaire on paper, but his family would have no money to pay taxes on the market value of his works. And it was
a
big deal.
Okay, just to be clear, though, if I wanted to get in on this whole burning my stuff in the desert, I can mm-hmm. just go in my backyard and burn the stuff. We live in the desert, so literally I go outside my house and I'm in the desert.
You're in the desert, right. I have a little thing we could burn it in. What should we burn?
Some mannequins?
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. No, that got a big no.
That got a big no.
I don't know. I feel like I don't want to burn any of my paintings because even the ones I don't like, I can just paint over them at some point.
Exactly. We're just reusing. We're into reuse, recycle.
And I was halfway through painting over one. It's like I basically blue washed it. I didn't like it, so I just painted blue over it. And I figured, well, that'd be a nice background for something else. And Jennifer, my wife, is like, oh, I like that. So now it's hanging in the house. It's like, well, that's like basically a gessoed canvas.
So it's just blue?
Blue, yeah.
I love it.
So I'm probably not allowed to paint over that one now.
Good enough.
Spouses are a real hassle sometimes.
Yeah, they can be.
What did I say? I say spouses are a real hassle sometimes. That's what I meant to say. I don't know what I actually did say.
I don't know. I'm agreeing. Anyway we've talked about what? What?
Can
now?
I just finish the show?
Finish with, the show.
Okay. So NPR did a piece on this as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think I saw this on MSNBC. MSN.
Right. Okay.
And they have a video of this, Hearst. Talking about, you know, the dilemma of NFTs are just as valuable as real art. And what's more valuable? Well, I don't know. What a little turd. Anyway, one of the commenters on the NPR story basically summed the whole thing up.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, interesting strategy of maximizing the carbon footprint for this collection.
Ooh.
So essentially he's pointing out that, okay, NFTs, we know, generate, require huge vasts
huge
of energy
amounts, right.
to encrypt and then to decrypt and to all do this other stuff.
Uh-huh.
So NFTs are by no means a low carbon thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually pretty high carbon, high energy, basically. And then you're burning petroleum products, the paintings.
Right.
Which it's not generally considered to be a good thing.
Right. And then
for no value.
Yeah, and
he's doubling it. It's like it's not only NFTing it, but he's also then burning actual physical things.
Right,
it
and then he used
it could not be worse. I'm sorry.
No, then he used like the actual petroleum products to start it, so he's like triple dipping, in a way. You know,
well, obviously, you're starting with if he's burning the petroleum products, he has them to begin with.
I know, but it's just like he used them. He could have used coal. Coal,
because that's probably worse.
Oh, where's this going? Damien Hearst makes me
statistic
nuts.
That I don't remember the statistic exactly, but it's something like you need 100 coal cars to power a power plant for a day.
Oh, wow.
And you need like, I don't remember, like maybe 3 train cars mm-hmm. of plutonium to run a reactor for like 30 years. Oh, so wow. I think the math was 1/1 trillionth of the amount of mass is used in nuclear energy as it is in coal. One trillion. Or it may have been like a trillionth of a trillionth.
Yeah,
I think it was a trillionth
coal.
Of a trillionth.
Let's bring back coal.
Oh, it's coming in anyway.
Oh, God. I'm not going to burn anything today. I'm going to clean.
Well, you know what's a good way to clean something?
Burn it.
Burn it. You never have to clean it again if it's burned.
Yeah.
You know, you burn everything in the house and you get a leaf blower and just blow everything out into the street.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Dust in the wind.
Dust in the wind.